Happy Sabbath. Welcome to UOpine. I met your friends at the dorm earlier this week, and it's great to see you guys again. Man, there's some crazy light refractions going on in the back here. That's going to distract me this entire time. It's really cool. This last summer, I mean, for the last couple years, actually, I've been really wanting to go on a trip that the university offers, and I was very excited about the opportunity that I might be able to go, and then this last summer, it became a reality. It's a trip that Dr. Kosart, one of the professors at the university, takes them on every other year, and it's a trip that goes to the Holy Lands, and we started out in Egypt. And then we went up to Jordan, and then to Israel, and then to Turkey. And in between, we got to stop off in Dubai, in the United Arab Emirates, and stop there for a few hours as well. So, it started off with my friend and I hopped in a car and went to Seattle. And then once we got there, we met up with 45 or 46 other university students that we're going to go with us on this trip, which is a really large group of people to be going to travel the Middle East with. So we got there. Only one person missed their flight, but he caught up with us later. And we took off over the North Pole, down into Dubai, where we stopped over for a couple hours, and then we landed in Cairo. That's where we started our trip. And see, there we go. So I have a couple pictures here. First one is of the pyramids, and actually I have several here of the pyramids because that was a major stop off in Cairo, was us at the pyramids. And so if you see the guy in the hat, he's behind me, and to my left, your guys' right, that's my professor, Dr. Kosart, who went, I'm going to open up something here really quick. Yeah, so these are the pyramids in Giza, and that was one of the major stops along the way. Here's a couple other pictures. This is great because we had these security guards with us the entire time. And in Egypt, there's these guys that had these semi-automatic weapons on their hips the entire that time. They were following us everywhere. And I asked him if he'd take this picture of me. And so he did. And he's like, oh, put your hand right here. I was like, okay, I'm going to do what you say. You have a gun. And I looked at it, and it was a really cool picture. I liked it a lot. There's most of our entire group. It's a little bit of a blurry picture there, but yeah, we just had so many sights of the pyramids while we were there. We got to go inside of them and see part of the tomb where they laid the pharaoh. It's another picture of the pyramids. that's Cameron, the guy I rode up with. We got a riding camel. We paid $10, and these guys, everything in Egypt and everywhere else we went, they expect tips for anything you do. And so we were told that in this ride, everything was included. The tip was included, so no matter what they said, we don't pay them anything extra. And so the entire time we were going, our guy who was leading our camel was like, okay, so if I make you happy, later you make me happy, right? I was like, yeah, I don't really know what that means. But yeah, make me happy. I like that. And so it's like, he let us do all these random things. He said, oh yeah, you guys should stand up on the camels. And so we stood up on the camels. That was fun. And then Cameron there, he was really timid, but he's like, oh, do you want to get a picture of yourself jumping off the camel? And he was like, yeah, no, probably not. But he got a lot of cool pictures of us with the camels. And afterwards, he took us aside and he's like, so you're going to make me happy, right? Where's the money? I was like, I just walked away. And then Cameron, he doesn't know how to say no very well. So he got stuck there for a bit, and then he paid the guy a couple dollars. It was fun. That's how it meant most of the trip. There's always somebody looking for a little extra, which is understandable in many of their circumstances. Here's another picture of camels. After Cairo, we spent a couple more days in Cairo. We went to the Cairo Museum, saw a lot of mummies and other things, mummified crocodiles, really cool statues and things. And then we went to a papyrus shop and found out how they make papyrus, which is like the sheets of paper kind of that they had back in the day that they wrote on that last for thousands of years. And then we hopped on a plane and we went to Aswan. And that's a town or a city in the southern part of Egypt. And while we were here, we went on a boat ride across the Nile. And we went up with the camels to this monastery called the Monastery of St. Simeon. And that was a real special day because while we were there, it was just very desolate. While we were in Egypt, there's a real narrow stretch of fertile land. The rest of it is really just desert. It's exactly what you'd imagine. So we went up to this monastery. There's another picture of us going up. Actually, going back to that. These guys, they meet us with the camels, right, at the Nile, and they take us up on the camel. And then they didn't have enough for all of us, so they book it back down to get some more of us. And one kid was just running his camel as fast as he could down this rocky stretch, and he fell off the back of his camel, and he jumped up as fast as he could, which is incredible because these things are tall. And he started chasing his camel, and the camel didn't stop, and it was just a really funny sight. And then the camel proceeded to be ornery after that. He'd start chasing the kid around once they got down to the bottom, and all the other camel drivers were just pointing at the kid and laughing and saying, like, "Oh, he'll learn." It was great. So we got up there, and this is what that monastery looked like. It was a place that was real populated during the 500 to probably 700 AD. People trying to get away from society, trying to get away from the people who they thought were just projecting their Christian life, and they wanted to really be, about living for Christ, you know. And maybe they weren't living for Christ out there, you know, being secluded, but they didn't want to be mold down with the rest of the world. So we got to have, like, time alone out here in the desert. It was real quiet and peaceful. And all over in this place, there's pottery shards from, you know, 1,000 years ago and longer, which is basically just the ancient plastic, you know, just the ancient litter everywhere. And to me, it's really, really cool. And then also in Aswan, we went to Abu Simbel, which is one of the crazy temples for Ramses II. And he also had his temple for Nefertari. And this day was, Nefertari was his queen. And this day was the hottest day of our trip. It was 120 degrees about. And this is Daphne, one of my friends. And she just wanted to find shade wherever she went. And so she was sitting beneath this tree, whatever it is, palm. Yeah. And so that was a very hot day. And it's a weird picture. But that's behind me. That's Abu Simbel. And there's the statues of Ramses. And it's actually really interesting because if you go back to this picture, that's the lake, what's it called? Nasser, Lake Nasser. And it's not a natural lake, it's man-made. And while it was getting more and more filled, this temple was under threat of being covered by water. And so they were trying to find out what to do with that. You know, do we make a dam around the entire thing or something? And they opted for moving the entire thing. So they took this entire temple apart piece by piece. The mountain is a mountain surrounding it. And they moved up here. And so that to me was just ridiculous and incredible. That was like late 1800s, I think. So here's, you can't see very well, but Egypt's up there. I'm sure you all can see Egypt. And we were down at the lower end of Egypt, so close to Sudan at this point. We could probably see Sudan. And from here, we went up and we caught our boat. That's not our boat. This is a good picture of what the Nile looked like. We caught a cruise, which we were on for 3 days after that. This is our cruise boat. That's Austin Greer. He was he worked under Pastor Johnson last year. He came here and gave a couple sermons. He was up there when I took this picture doing a morning worship. And we stopped at temples along the way on this trip. And so this is one of our stops off the cruise. That's we hopped on a carriage ride, and they were racing each other down the streets trying to get us to the temple. And behind me is Dr. Thomas, who's one of the other professors that went with us from the university. And there's another guy in the carriage passing us. At this point in the trip, we stopped at a lot of temples. We were stopping at a temple every day, at least one or two, sometimes three. And so temples were getting real boring for me at this point. You know, you see Egyptian symbols that you don't know long enough, and you start to not care as much, especially when it's 110 plus every day. And so this was probably the most exciting point of the temples for me. which is kind of sad. But if you see the guy in white, you might not know who he is, but that's Colin Kaepernick. He's kind of a big figure in the media. He was a 49ers quarterback who went to the Super Bowl about 4 years ago, and so we saw him. And that was really interesting to me, just randomly in the middle of nowhere in Egypt along the Nile. He was on another cruise boat right next to us. And here's another temple. Another temple. Oh, that's me. There's an obelisk you can kind of see behind me. Another temple. Okay, going back. So after we were done in Egypt, we went and we caught another flight and we went to Jordan, to Amman in Jordan. And from Amman, we went to, first, this is Machaerus, which is one of the wilderness fortresses of Herod the Great. And Herod the Great really was a phenomenal builder. Some of my highlights on the trip, most of my highlights, I'd say, were things that Herod the Great built. And this is very connected to the Bible as well. If you see the caves that go around kind of at the base of that mountain and also other areas, you got to go into those caves and look at them. And this is where it is that John the Baptist was imprisoned before he was beheaded. And so that's just a really interesting sight. And then from there we went to Mount Nebo. And this is Mount Nebo here, the view. You can see the Dead Sea off in the distance. You can see the Dead Sea off in the distance of this one as well. And from the Dead Sea, you can see all the way, you know, if it was clear, probably all the way to Egypt. And then the other side, you can see all the way to the Holy Land, the Promised Land, where they were headed along their trip. You know, the Israelites were set free from Egypt when we started, and we just followed their kind of their trajectory, at least, not their path, clearly, because we were on a plane most of the time, or a bus, but going up. And then the next day, we got to go to Petra. And so this is the entrance to Petra. It looks like this for about a mile and a half or so. And it's just these crazy cliffs that go up. And Petra is just an amazing sight. And you come out, and this is the first thing you see is this, they call it the treasury. I'm pretty sure it's actually something that has to do with their religion, this building. But in this place, this, all that we saw, this here, all of it is only 1% excavated, they say. So there's still 99% of this area that is still unexcavated. And so this is the site of the Nabataeans, who probably you've never heard of, maybe, but like they were some famous traders between 200 BC and 280, and they're connected to the Bible. And one place really is a king of the Nabataeans who wanted to capture Paul and have him arrested or killed when Paul escaped from the basket in Damascus. And so that's really the only connection we have from the Bible to the Nabataeans, but they were a great trading society during that time. This is the high place within Petra. We did a lot of hiking that day. I think I went 14 miles or something like that, and I was in flip-flops the whole day. And so I was in pain for a while after that after that day. And so then the next, that evening, we stayed in a hotel right along the Dead Sea, which was great for like weary bodies in reality because it's very healing. But it's also very painful if you have little cuts all over your body, which I did at that point. And the salt, it just burns. It was terrible. This isn't actually my picture. I didn't have a picture of myself in the Dead Sea or anybody else. I didn't take any pictures at this point. And so this is just a random one off the internet. But it's true. You do just float there just like that. You can just lean back, and it's crazy. You get to 1 foot deep water, and they say, just sit down. You're like, oh, okay. You sit down, and all of a sudden you're floating. And that was just amazing. And then we came to, we went from the Dead Sea, and we traveled up in our boat, a bus, not our boat, our bus, up through the border into Israel. And the border crossing took like 5 hours because we had one guy in our group who, his parents are Syrian, and he had been to Syria recently. And if you know about the struggles in the Middle East, you know that the Israelis are not big fans of the Syrians. And so they held him up for 5 hours, and they probably would have held him up for a lot longer if he wasn't with a big group that was clearly not malicious in nature. So then we went straight to Galilee, and this was my favorite place along the entire tour. I mean, I liked all the sites But there was nowhere else on the tour that I thought I could live. Galilee is just amazing. They can grow anything. They were growing banana trees, mango trees, there's wheat fields, there's anything you can think of. There's beautiful cliffs. Then we got to go out on the Sea of Galilee over to Capernaum, where Christ spent most of his ministry and where he lived. And that was incredible too, you know, just being able to see exactly where Christ would have seen, walk where he would have walked. It opens up the Bible in ways I couldn't have imagined. So that's us on the boat. Here's overlooking the Valley of Megiddo, where several amazing, or not amazing, but tragic battles have happened over time. Battles between pharaohs, battles between Canaanites, battles between Israelites, battles between great forces during the World War. And it's just a history in that valley that is immense. So I took a picture of it. And this is another picture of the valley. And this is the top of Mount Carmel, where Elijah set fire down on the offering for God with the prophets of Baal. That was a really cool sight. It has an amazing view, and they took all the water up from this. You can see like how far down the base of this mountain is to get that water up for Elijah to douse the altar that he made. It must have taken a lot of work. That was bizarre for me to encounter, to see how much work that would have taken. Then we got to see, this is Caesarea. Philippi. Caesarea. This is where Herod built his, this is on the Mediterranean Sea, and there's no really great harbors in this area. The greatest harbor in the world at that point was in Alexandria, and Herod wanted to make a harbor that rivaled that, and which is really difficult here because the breaks, they don't make for that. There's no natural breaks for the water, and so it just comes and pounds the shore all the time. And so he made some, what's the word, hydraulic concrete, something that he mixed, I think it was volcanic ash or rock together with other stuff, and he sunk them in the boats, and it hardens once it hits the water. And so he made a natural kind of harbor there that was huge, that rivaled pretty much any other known architecture of the time, you know. It was incredible. And here's another thing that Herod the Great built. This is Masada. Probably best known for when the 10th Legion of Rome came and they overtook Masada, because that's when, in 70 AD, when the Israelis, or the Israelites, they banded against the Romans and they revolted and they killed one of their legions. They took it out, wiped it out, which doesn't happen to the Romans, right? And so they had to send a message, and so they basically obliterated the Israeli nation at that point. And Masada has a crazy story to go along with that. If you see the sand or the dirt and everything going at the side, that's what the 10th Legion built to bring a battering ram up to forge or siege the city. And in the end, the Jews knew that they were going to be overtaken. And so they decided to opted for, instead of having all the negative things that would come after an angry legion having spent months, you know, sieging the city in the middle of the desert would do to them, they decided to kill themselves and their families. And so they got up there, and just close to 1,000 dead Jews were up there just waiting for them, except for two. A woman and her daughter hid in one of their cisterns. There's me getting ready to storm Masada. But this is one of the cisterns, and each one of these cisterns holds, I believe they told us, like 10 million gallons of water about, which is just bizarre. And so they found them hiding inside these cisterns, and that's how they knew about the story of the Jews who cast lots to find out who would in the end have to kill themselves, you know, because one person couldn't be killed, so they had to kill himself. So another picture off the side of Masada overlooking the Dead Sea, which was, it's a beautiful view. And the way they filled their cisterns was incredible. So because this land is so foreign to water, when water hits it, it just flash floods like crazy. I think a few years ago, there was a man who wanted to get a view of the flash floods, and he died because it's just so intense. So we went out at an opportune time, And so what they did was when these flash floods hit, they had these aqueducts that came up to Masada, and all that water we funneled into these aqueducts, and that's how they filled all that those gallons of water. So when the legion, the 10th legion of Rome, first got there, they thought, well, we'll just wait them out. They can't have that much water. And they found out really quickly that they made a mistake and that they were the ones in lack of water, because they saw the women up on top. They were just washing their laundry and dumping the water off the side. And they like thought, oh, no. Well, we have made a drastic decision here to be out here in the middle of this desert. But in the end, they accomplished what their goal was anyhow, as Rome always did. Then we went and we traveled. At this point, we were traveling further towards Jerusalem. And along the way, we stopped. This is the valley behind me where David slew Goliath. And this is probably one of my favorite points of the trip because I think a lot about my childhood in Patty's Sabbath school room, singing when David killed Goliath, and the giant came a-tumbling down. And those were some of the best days. You know, David was my hero and still is in many ways. So this valley was, I was sitting there reflecting about it a bit, and one of my friends snapped this picture, and I liked it a lot. So then we got to Jerusalem, and the first day we went outside of Jerusalem over to the West Bank, and we went to the Herodium, which is where Herod was buried after he died. And the Herodium is another great feat that Herod had. So there were two small mountainish hills next to each other, and he took one of them and completely leveled it, basically, and put it on top of the other one because he wanted to be able to see as far as he could. And then he built crazy tunnels all the way throughout the Herodium that you could go inside of. We went inside of them. We came out the side there, walking through the tunnels that go down beneath it. It was just an incredible builder. And then we got to Jerusalem. And so you can see the walls of Jerusalem, the old city, which are right behind me. And then you can barely see it behind my arm, maybe, but that's the Dome of the Rock, which was one of the highlights of the tour as well. So we all got these shamas, or whatever you want to call them. They all call them different things in different countries. But I got this picture because it represents a lot of what the trip was. This is mine. But there's one of my buddies, Troy. He snapped this picture on my phone. And then there's another guy behind him, Justin, getting his together to put on. And so those were a lot of fun for us. And below us at this point, right here, is the Mount of Olives. Right below us in the Mount of Olives, they're overlooking the city where Jesus would have had some of the best times of his life, I'm sure, and also probably the worst time of his life. And then we went and we got to go inside the old city of Jerusalem, inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, which is maybe the most volatile area in the world. It's important to practically all major religions in the world, important to Islam, important to Christianity, important to Jews. And it was crazy to be there, you know. At this point, Muslims, they have the Dome of the Rock there, and they'll deny that the Temple Mount ever was there, that that's the place where Solomon had his temple, where the temple was in the time of Jesus. We were up there, and our professor started talking about the Temple Mount, and a guy came over and started yelling at him. He's like, "You don't tell your stories here. Those aren't real. If you want to hear the real history here, you ask us." And that was crazy, because you go 300 yards away and they'll start showing you the architecture beneath and what it was all like during the times of Christ. But there's a lot of emotions that go along with this area right here. And being non-Muslims ourselves, we couldn't actually go inside the Dome of the Rock. I think they closed that off I want to say 7 years ago, but it might have been longer. It might have been 17 years ago. I don't know. So nobody else can go in. And this is the Western Wall, where it came out. It's called the Wailing Wall. And these are all mostly Hasidic Jews. You can tell who they are by the curls they have going down their face. And they separate themselves on men on one side and women on the other. If you can see, the men are on the left and the women on the right. And then they all day long, there'll be somebody here, at least, praying on the wall. And I talked to one guy, asking him why he was there, and he's like, "Oh, yeah, just give me a minute. I don't know if I can actually tell you because it's so emotional for me." And basically, he was just so sad, you know. He feels like the last 2,000 years, practically, he's been in exile from the place where you feel God the most, where God is a reality. And so for him and all of them there, this is a tragic thing to have the Dome of the Rock where they believe God is both to reign and live. And so we also came here Friday night for bringing in the Shabbat, the Sabbath. And that's crazy. Like in that area, all they're doing is dancing. They're dancing in circles, bringing in the Sabbath. They're singing their songs, like Havanagala, and they're dancing, and it's fun. It was a lot of fun. We got people on like each other's shoulders that were just going crazy. And then Sabbath comes in, and they become more reverent, and it's just a beautiful way to bring in the Sabbath. And from there, we left Jerusalem. After going to many other sites, we went to see the site of where David's palace would have been. You can see like the structure is still beneath. They're excavating now. We got to see the Via Della Rosa, where Christ would have walked with the cross. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Christ is supposed to have been buried. I believe that's where Christ was buried. And there's so many sites in Jerusalem that were immensely incredible for me to view. Also, the Dome of the Rock, 16 hours after we were at the Dome of the Rock, this is just to show how volatile that area is. Three Palestinian Israelis snuck up inside that area and they shot two of the IDF, the Israel Defense Force soldiers who were guarding the area, killed them, and then they were killed immediately because Israel has a no tolerance policy. If you have a gun and you're up there, you're shot, you're killed immediately. And after that, a lot of problems stemmed from it. So the next day we went to visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, we were literally the only ones walking the streets, basically. There were guards on every corner and everything, but all the shops were shut down. We were walking through the streets. I got to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and there was maybe a wait of like 10 people or something like that, which is unheard of. We were going down the Via Della Rosa, and typically there would be like hundreds of people at this time of day, and there was no one. And after that, there was a lot of protesting. The Muslims were angry because the Israelis started to implement new defense mechanisms like metal detectors to go into the Dome of the Rock and stuff, or into the Alaska Mosque complex, and that did not sit well with them. So since then, there's been a lot of changes that have been going on, actually, in this area. And then we went to Turkey after that. And in Turkey, we visited, you know, the churches that are all mentioned inside the New Testament, like Ephesus and Laodicea, and all of those, and that was incredible. I won't go through them each, but each of them was unique in its own way. It shows you a new way of looking at what the Bible kind of is trying to tell you. Like with Laodicea, one thing that was incredible, you know, we always talk about Laodicea as, the one church that Christ had nothing good to say about, you know, they're lukewarm, you want to spit them out of your mouth. And the reason I think Christ used that metaphor is because from Laodicea, and go to some of the churches and temples and things, this is Hierapolis, and this is the water source for Laodicea. And it starts out hot. This is an area of healing in the ancient world of Turkey. And the water would come down hot. By the time it got to Laodicea, it would be lukewarm. So Christ always spoke in metaphors that people could understand, you know? He told them what they were by things that they, you know, could see. They hated the water. They spat it out because it was disgusting. And that's how Christ described them. And that's how it was everywhere Christ went. He talked with people in ways that they could understand and take in what he was trying to say. And then this is the last picture I took on a trip. This is our hotel last week. We were supposed to go to Patmos in Greece, but we didn't because there was a warning on the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, the Aegean Sea here, whatever you want to call it. I guess it's the same thing. It's kind of how it was explained to me. But so we didn't get to go because of the warning from the harbor master. And instead, we went to a water park that day. And that was a lot of fun, too. But we got to go out and experience some of the culture of Turkey, go out and get some souvenirs and things. And that's how we ended our trip, really relaxing. But now I'm going to share with you a few things that I learned from the trip and things that became very important to me from this trip. It wasn't simply something that opened up the Bible to me in a new way that was, you know, bizarre and vivid. And it opened the Bible, and so it was like black and white before, and now it's in color, it felt like. You can see why Christ talked about certain things the way he did, because of the areas that they were affecting. So I'm gonna read through here a bit. For me on this trip, I feel like I learned more what it means to be a follower of Christ. We read a book before we left called The Son of Hamas, and it's about a man named Mossab, and he was one of the sons of one of the seven founders of the group Hamas, which basically rules the Gaza Strip now, and is responsible for many terrorist acts in the world. And this man, Mossab, he talks about the most radical thing that has ever entered this world. And that is what Brett talked about, or he already read from the Bible, loving your enemies. When he came across this, it was so foreign to him. Loving your enemies, you know, that's something that is so unique to Christianity. And he couldn't grasp it. It didn't make any sense. Why would you love your enemies? That doesn't do anything for me, right? And so he struggled with that idea when he first heard it. He didn't like it, especially because he was a devout Muslim, and his father was a leader in the Muslim community and an imam, you know. And so he couldn't give this any thought. But as time went along, he started to experience things in his life that showed him how much he was loved by this God. They told him of these things that Christ did for him. That God did for him, creation, his death on the cross, the Sabbath, all these things are fantastic examples of love. And he started experiencing these examples of love in his life. And suddenly it stopped not making sense to him that love was the answer for him in this world. And he talks about the most radical idea is when Christ came into this world and he told others to love more than yourself, those around you. Christ, he's phenomenally above us. He created us, and yet he was willing to die for us, humble himself to the point where he was below us. And for him to experience this love is what started him to realize that loving others is all that mattered in this world for him. And as time went on, like the crazy thing is, you know, start 2,000 years before Christ, and you have Abraham, given a covenant that through him the world would be blessed immensely, all nations would be blessed. And you get to 2,000 years later, and through that lineage, you have Christ given to us where the world is blessed. And now we're 2,000 years later, and that blessing, what he was trying to tell us about loving others, is still just as radical today, and people still don't grasp it today and can't understand how that would make sense. And the only way for it to make sense is to realize that we are loved truly and deeply, and to see what that does to us in our lives and how that transforms us. So in reading that verse, I'm going to ask you to read it one more time. Go to it, Matthew, Mark, Luke. If you want to read along, it's 6:35 of Luke. Sorry, I didn't say that out loud. But it says, "But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful." So in some ways, I believe that love is the answer for everybody in the world, right? It's the answer to change things. But more than that, I believe knowing we are loved is the greatest answer for the world. Unless we know we are loved, we cannot be changed by the world, by God. We cannot begin to express. And accepting that we are loved is the hardest thing that anybody has ever done in their life. But there's phenomenal examples. The Sabbath is one of them. A gift given, our lives, creation, a gift given. Our lives for eternity, a gift given. We are phenomenally loved. So if there's one thing that I want you to take away from my tour, is to realize that I now know more that I am loved. And that is what I loved about this trip.